Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Barca with Andy Lipson, and today's topic will be a very informal, casual, lazy,
Eduardo on the hot seat
conversation. Andy has decided to make I think we have both decided, I guess. We wanted something easy for this week. And this reminds me a lot of the red blue pill episode we had done. And I don't even know where we're heading with this. So we're improvising. And for folks that are listening.
Well, let me say so, where we're heading.
I hope that you will have a very nice and calming weekend with this.
Yes. So first off, last episode, at the end, Eduardo had talked about some changes that he had undergone as a result of your trip to Florida. Right? And I thought that some of the things he had said at the end of the episode, to me, I felt like we should go a little more deeply into them. Part of it, yes, is like, you know, I'm not really sure there's anything that's happened this week that I felt like the way we talked about it was, if anything really pressing happens this week politically, we would discuss it. But if nothing big happens, mm-hmm. I think this was worth getting into. Secondly, I think one of the things we've been missing on this show is more about you. And I think this gives us an opportunity to learn more about you. So this week, we're going to kind of go into what that trip from Florida was about, or rather, the changes that you were describing at the end of the episode. I want to go more deeply into them and find out, you know, what were those changes and why they happened and who you were before and where are you at now? That's the idea, at least.
Yeah, well, we can use that as a prompt, and I hope that we can go into other areas.
We'll see.
Into this rabbit hole.
Yes.
So,
you're anxious about this discussion, it seems.
Well, I'm not used to being a focus of attention.
Yeah. That's what I'm used to hearing. So,
I mean, privately, I suppose I share with you a lot of things.
Yeah.
But friendship-wise as well, I think that I tend to focus more on others because I just don't share a lot in that sense. I'm not even sure why I said that right now. But
yeah. Yeah.
But in general, I think even... that's just me. And for this episode, I thought when you mentioned it, I thought, oh, this is such a cop-out. You want such a lazy way of doing something, and you're going to use me as...
It's true.
but you've been trying to get me to say something on many things.
Yeah. So you want to get started?
Yeah.
Okay. So I sent Eduardo some questions, but I don't think I'm really going to go off directly those questions that I had sent you to think about.
You took me like four questions, right?
Or six or something like that. I guess what I'll start with is, let's just get into how would you describe the changes or the changed perspective you had as a result of before Florida and after Florida?
Right. Well, I think I have been hesitant to talk about, and I will state that my friend Jake and I have been friends since we were teenagers. And when in our adolescence, and we sort of became very, very close because we grew up in the Jehovah's Witness religion. And it was both of us during that time leaving this or transition. We were not yet leaving. We knew each other for some time, and then we had decided to separately, in our own way, slowly withdraw ourselves from the religion, and we tried to do it in a way that was less impactful for our families that are heavily invested in the religion. And so we sort of went our way figuring that out, but we were we I think we sought refuge in each other as we were going through the experience. And we sort of had a very empty, just void within us, because we were indoctrinated for a very long time. And we basically had, we were very righteous to think that this was the way to do things, which was the Jehovah's Witness way, the religion. And we both, as we were going on our path in life without God, because we both are atheists now. I don't like to talk about myself, Andy. It makes me very... just I have to edit in this.
No, but, yeah. You're doing fine. It's good.
So as we were on our own journey, we still maintained our friendship. We were very close to each other. And I think I was, you know, he was raised in Idaho. I was raised in Mexico and California. And my mother had me travel abroad a lot. So my experience was very multifaceted. But he was raised in what I think would Idaho be considered middle of the USA.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
It's
on the western still.
Yes, but it's more the center of the... It's more considered... It's not the coasts.
Yeah.
You know, it would be more the conservative red state kind of...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Stuff. Red state. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Small town. It was my very first experience when I was 17 going over to... Or 16. Going over to a small state. A small town. It is that feel, that small town, everyone knows each other sort of feeling. So he was raised in that sort of environment, and I was raised in a different environment. So just to sort of not make a long story short, he was sort of swept. He was influenced a lot by the politics of where he grew up. Mm-hmm. And I was influenced by the politics of my upbringing as well. Once we left the religion, and we were both entering what is sort of like a polar opposite end of the spectrum of
politically.
Politically, yes. Yet we somehow were not completely on that side politically, because I had some issues with communism at that time. Because, you know, I'm Mexican, and in Mexico, you had a lot of propaganda about Cuba. And just if you're Latin American, you just hear this constant, constant news about Fidel Castro. You're constantly being raised.
Positive.
It's negative. It's always negative.
Yeah.
I think all of Latin America wants to try not to become like Cuba. I'm not talking about the people. I think the governments. I think it's the governments. I try to feed that propaganda to the media. And yet I still felt very much part of the left. And for him as well, he didn't like much of what we're seeing now, which is considered maybe the alt-right. But he still considers himself very conservative, traditional value system, and sort of that sphere of the right, with like business and money making, and making sure there's less government influence in your business and less government in general. So we had issues with these areas, and yet we maintained our friendship. I think why I'm mentioning all of this is because we have come to somehow connect deeply this past time that I was there for last week. I was there for 10 days, I think, or 15, I forget now. But we were talking about this, and he and I just sort of went our own way politically, but would always have these conversations through the phone, arguing. And I think the more he argued with me, the more I embraced a lot of the socialism ideology, and he embraced more of the, I think, more of a right libertarian ideology. Mm-hmm. And with time, we just sort of eventually came back together, and we had agreed on other things, like climate change things. And where I think we started to really, as time went on, we really hit a point for us that was almost, there was a lot of tension between us politically, was when I visited him in 2017. It was right after the elections of 2016, and we were both Bernie Sanders supporters, which we both are not anymore, both of us actually. But at that time in 2016, we were very Bernie Sanders supporters. He liked Bernie Sanders, an independent that tried to run as a candidate, the Democrat, as a Democrat, and I liked him for that as well. And we both, in 2016, we just had a different way of, we want a different outcome that we'd both envisioned. In 2017, right after, there were some series of things that started happening, like the Women's March, and Black Lives Matter became a stronger theme, and the topic of
And the events in Charlottesville too.
yes, that was huge. Now, so I was going in there, and just the conversations around political privilege, and the differences in intersectionality. This is when everything was, we were beginning to have some differences, but when we were in 2017 in August, I was visiting him, and there was the alt-right and Nazis, I would say, and some I think would identify themselves as KKK. I remember I saw a documentary. They were all at Charlottesville, and Heather Heyer had was murdered. And prior to her death, we had visited Northern Florida, and I did share this in one of our episodes here at What's Left, where post-Trump, there was a lot of rhetoric around America first. And I remember we were camping, and we went to,
You and Jake.
yes, we went to a river, and we were talking, and we went out, and we went to float on some tubes, and then we went on on the bank of the river to just to talk. And there were some folks there, there were Latinos there, mostly from Cuba. And I was speaking to them in Spanish and everything. And there were some white people that got onto the shore, the bank of the river, and they started yelling at us who were speaking Spanish to speak Spanish. And one of the, I remember one of the guys was wearing, a Cuban guy was wearing shorts that were with the US American flag, and said, and the white person said, "You shouldn't wear that flag because you're not even a US American." And in my mind, I was like, how does he even know he's not a US American? You can just read people and know. But I think he meant that because you are a Latino or Spanish speaking person, you don't identify as what we think a US American should look like, which is Caucasian, which is white. And all kinds of epithets were yelled at us. And I, you know, just sort of went away and went towards Jake. Jake didn't hear it. He was doing something. He was trying, I think he was climbing a tree to launch himself from a rope onto the river. And I was heading towards Jake, but they were really coming. There were a group of white guys that were young men that were coming towards us. And I quickly said in Spanish to the rest of the other Latinos, I said to them that they were saying these epithets and that they should be careful because I don't think they spoke English much. And so I went with Jake, and they started yelling. There was a commotion, and I went with Jake, and I sort of wanted to stay there to see what would happen. Nothing luckily happened, but there was a lot of yelling and insults and threats. And I felt afraid. I felt really afraid for myself. I cannot hide. If we look at the camera just right now, I mean, I'm darker than you are. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't exactly look Caucasian. Mm-hmm. I went over to Jake and I tried to turn around so that I wouldn't be looked at as, and I told Jake, I want to go somewhere else because I don't feel safe here. And Jake thought, what? Why? And I said, I just don't feel safe here because the things that they're saying. And he looked over and was trying to hear. He's like, they're not talking about you. I said, they're talking about people that look like me, Jake. Or people with using the language that I use. Mm-hmm. And Jake's like, well, that could be said to anyone. I mean, maybe they're just saying those specific things to them. I thought, Jake, I didn't know how to convey the message that I was really didn't feel safe. They were clearly stating things that made me feel unsafe. They were talking about the color of our skin. They're talking about the language we speak. They were saying that we're not U.S. Americans. They were saying that we shouldn't even wear, one of the guys that I was talking to shouldn't wear that shorts. It's very clear who they were. Why were they talking about us? And they kept saying Trump, 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 right? I mean, how else do you need to identify that these people are speaking racially motivated? Mm-hmm. But the way that Jake, I think the way that he looked at it was that they're using that against you at that moment because that's what you represent to them at the moment, but they could be targeting to anyone and use some other epithet against them. That's what he was saying. I think that's what, I cannot speak for him, but
yeah.
I think he was saying that if it's not that, they'll say something else to someone that is Asian. They'll say something else to another person that's white, but they'll use other insults to say something about that white person. I think that that was his reasoning, that it's not, they weren't, something around, and I feel bad because I shouldn't actually speak for him. I will just say this. I really struggled trying to convince my best friend, we're knowing each other from our adolescence, that I felt unsafe as someone that can clearly understand what racially motivated language threats are. Mm-hmm. And he didn't get it. I should say Jake's white. I didn't mention that. But he is mixed as well, but not really. His mother is, I think, comes from Spanish and Portuguese background. So it really frustrated me. And I really thought long and hard when we were going home on the car ride how much I felt like I didn't need to explain that. I thought he would get it, but I guess I somehow missed it. And then I started thinking about our childhood and thinking about how he just didn't understand some things or the things that he had said in front of me, and maybe I was too quiet and I hadn't spoken up before. And just even the things that he would say about Mexicans, not negatively, but sort of stereotypes that he would say, and I would have to remind him that I am Mexican, and he thought, oh yeah, I forgot you're Mexican. Or like he would say something that I don't think is harmful, but I've heard it many times that people would say, what he had said to me when I was growing up, he said, you don't act Mexican. You don't live, you don't act or you don't live your life like a Mexican. I think he was referring to so many of my background being very diverse. And just that, I think that was just our struggle. But I didn't actually make any fuss about it at that time. I think we were just being kids at that time. But I think post-Trump, we were sort of, both of us at that time, we were being super mm-hmm. aware of everything. And in the car ride back, I had said to him that he just needed to understand that when I say that I feel unsafe, it's not so much that I make this stuff up. I truly do feel unsafe when people are saying specific things about me or a group of us. And I'm not making stuff up. And I know that sometimes people will use the race card to sort of say, that everyone is thinking of them racially. For example, someone might say, oh, they didn't give me that discount because I'm black. And I'm sure there are racially motivated stuff, but it's always in that vague gray area because they're not saying clearly what is there. I do believe that racism exists, but this one was very clear, and I tend to just not operate that people are thinking of me because I'm Mexican. I tend to sort of see the goodness and just, if someone decides to do something like not to give me a discount or not let me on or not trust me or look at me a certain way on the BART, on train, I tend to sort of operate under the illusion that it's because of something else other than my race and not be it as my default. That's how I try to live my life. But this one was clear, and I just was trying to tell him that, like, and we kept going back and forth, and he's talking about his own experiences being targeted and being bullied, or the sort of backlash he's gotten for saying things or that. And I thought, why are we talking about you right now? Talking about me? But all right. So, because I was being very sympathetic to him. I'm sorry that happened, or people have said things to you. And I tried to really redirect the conversation back to me and tell him, like, please understand this, Jake, please. And I think it was a conversation that I really had with him for the first time to, like, you have to respect me, and you have to truly understand as a friend that when I ask a request for you to really look out for me, and when I'm asking you if we want to move away, I would do the same if you felt that way. Mm-hmm. Anywhere. And it just became very political. Anyhow, Heather Hire happened. We went back to our lodging at that time. And after the Heather Hire thing, I was really upset after this experience at the camping ground. And I was really upset about that. I was upset about just Jake's conversation with me. And then that, I think, was the moment we both had a very strong disagreement about racism. And I went home to some here in San Francisco, and we both just began these Facebook comment wars against each other, which I'm sure still lives out there in the ether if you want to look up. But we began these, just we began aggressively commenting on Facebook against each other. And I became even more interested in racism as it is used here in the USA, because I'm familiar of racism that exists in Mexico, and I'm familiar with it as what I think everyone knows, that this country was largely the founders even have always been founding this country based on racism, to exclude the Native Americans, to consider we the people as people who look like us, the founders, and slaves, black slaves, chattel slavery as property. Mm-hmm. So I didn't think I had to look any further. I think it's quite clear. But when we started arguing, it became more of like slavery. He would say things like slavery has been part of history that has affected all of races. And I thought, yes, it's true. And I guess I'm trying to speed up here where my process is going with this, but I guess where I realized where we were going with this is that we were really going and delving into areas that we did not explore before. And we were not looking for common ground. I think he was trying to. He was trying to say, like, I also experience repression. I also experience, I experience bigotry. And I experience people saying stuff about me as well. And the things that he was talking about were very individual based and not structural. So you know, just being the person that I am, I do think that people can be affected, whatever you are, individually. I think it hurts when anyone says that you, whatever has happened to you, your experience, is invalid. And I am very sympathetic to anyone, whichever race they are, that if someone did something to you or said something to you that made you feel unsafe or unheard, or I'm very sympathetic to it. I was very, but at that time I was pointing out to the structural racism that exists in this country and in our institutions and government and schools and, you know, and everything that has to do with the financial sector, with private sector, with public sector. And so we went into this, and I didn't think we would be friends anymore at that time. And I consulted your help.
It didn't help that much.
We were both stuck on different
Yeah,
paths.
you would ask me to have a conversation, like from a different viewpoint,
Yeah.
as a white person, basically,
Yeah.
talking to him about race and racism, and it wasn't that successful.
No, it was not. Yeah. So I think I dug my heels in more with the left on going into even allying myself with a lot of what I would think as progressive politics, and even embraced political privilege at some point, and became very almost swayed by groupthink and almost tribal in a way for just a period of time during that scary time. Something I didn't think of myself to be. It when I say tribal is as I sort of just didn't look further into some things that I would consider just to be, like for example, the Democrats would say things and they would try to do a lot of anti-Trump rhetoric that would try to bring in people closer together so that we can sort of align ourselves against Trump and not look into really the Democratic Party as even as a scam that is trying to really just divide us for a political cause and not for a greater cause. And so I think that I got swept up a little bit in that. I prior to Trump, I think I was mainly just purely working on academic politics and sort of really understanding through a lot of activism like protests and campaigning. I was in part of large campaigns, but I hadn't looked into issues deeply as I think post-Trump, such as structural racism, such as what it means to have, what it means to be pro-capitalist or not. I think I sort of just trusted the leaders in whether it be in Occupy or whether it was in the campaign for one of the candidates for mayoral race here in San Francisco. And just did a lot of reading on Noam Chomsky, but sort of philosophically talked about it and didn't really see it as something material that could be possibly used for as to do as a framework to live your life as how we were how are we supposed to operate in actively instead of just seeing the ballot box as one way. But rather to use, for example, Marxism or Chomskyism, I would say, truly as lifestyle almost, right? As a political lifestyle to really operate on that. And I just think I was just swept up by work, by a kid, and just leaders. So post-Trump, I think I looked into issues, specific issues, and not the news, but issues deeply. And I think most of us, when we think politically, we're always touching about what the current news are, what's going on, and sort of focus on philosophizing, right? And I think I started to look deeper into issues and seeing, well, what is it, this, where is the root cause of all this? And where is, how, how do we then find a collectivism that we can try to really find something that can benefit us all, like everyone, all people, instead of just the individual? Or how can we actually save our planet? And will it be through the vehicle of legislation, or is there something deeper than that? What about my own life that I live as a vegetarian and always recycling and always having a garden and making sure that I have low impact by riding my bike? Is that really effective? Is that sort of the life that I think I should be preaching about? Is there something deeper than that? And I think that sort of moved me to looked into life as there's something bigger than this in the background that I need, I'm not paying attention to. And I'm just trying to superficially take care of things and getting exhausted. And I thought maybe I just being a teacher, I thought that was my next step. And my next move was to be in education. And then I started to dismantle what our education system is like. Mm-hmm. So then you looked into how it does intersect with racism, and it does intersect with sort of education as sort of the feeder to how we are supposed to work in this system. And I just sort of started looking into all of this. And then I sort of had let go of many of the ways that I thought about the left and progressive politics, which you can be very, you can be very, what do you call it, you can be very buried in when you live here in the Bay Area. Over time, I was able to sort of strategize my conversations with Jake to sort of see where he was coming from as well. And listening to him sort of gave me an idea of how I should approach my conversations, because I think it was always... anything was in opposition to him. And when I started to see about slavery, he was right. Yes, there was slavery for blacks, whites, Native Americans, brown folk. And I began to look at, well, what was the root of that? And it became more than just a black issue or a racism issue. It became more of a capitalist issue. And that's what it started to see. And when we talked about the climate, we were not discussing whether well, the best way to deal with climate versus tax credits and carbon tax. I began personally to stop discussing policies that we would argue about, but rather see it as it affects us all equally, and there's something that is there that is not going to be solved with policies. Again, profits, capitalism. And so the conversation started to be less about sort of the surface of a great issue like racism or the environment or sexism or another one would be just war, right? Immigration. It started not to be about superficially how to deal with those things. It became, for me, it became deeper and deeper to see where is this all stemming from. And listening to him, I was able to then...
And are you describing the conversation now that you had on the most recent trip?
No, okay. You're right. Okay. And so when I began began to ruminate about this, it became clear to me that we were not discussing any of the issues at the root of the cause of the matter. So over time, just to fast forward, we began having different conversations, ones where we can find some common ground and yet also find disagreements and really look at where our disagreements really lie. And this time around in Florida, I tried to do that a lot, to not come at him as a debate, But really listen to him and listen for why he thinks these things happen and see where it stems from. And in listening to that, I can see that he sees a lot of, I'll speak about him, I'll speak about other people, he sees a lot of that stemming from the government. And the government, like for example, he'll say things like, the fossil fuel industry is subsidized by the government. And then I will trace that in my head and think, well, yes, it is subsidized by the government because the government's lying in bed with these people because it works for both. And that's why we have what we have, which is an oligarchy. And so he wouldn't say this, but that's how I can see, I interpret, right? He wants less government as a libertarian. And I can see and trace back why he is saying that, but he will not use the words that I'm using. And I see it. I see ICE will agree with you. And that is an oligarchy. And that functions under what? Under capitalism. And so it makes sense for me. And I would listen to him like that. And so, and I did the same thing with other people that we talk about immigration. And so people would say things, the immigrants here, the immigrants that. And they would say, we cannot take everyone in. And then I would. When sometimes people talk about, and I'd ask them, well, why do you feel this way? Or what's so threatening about immigrants, right? Or some immigrants are favorable and other immigrants are not. Then people talk about their jobs. And people talk about scarcity. And people talk about a change in their community. I mean, they're not saying it like this. This is what I have. I'm listening to them and I ask them questions and I bring it down to this scarcity, change in the community. Well, of course, anyone feels a bit threatened by change. You don't know what, if you live in a small town and a bunch of people come from Ethiopia or Somalia or whatever, and they speak in a different language, have different customs, and you're used to sort of sharing your sugar with another neighbor, but these people don't want to share sugar with you because they don't know you. They come from a war-ravaged country, and you can't trust anyone in your country because everyone is sort of giving you in to the Taliban or whoever. Of course, you're not going to share sugar with your neighbor, and you're coming to the USA, and then they want that sort of ambiance as well. Well, people are coming with trauma, right? And then they talk about, and I heard this a lot in London. I remember when I was in England living there, that people just didn't want change because people weren't friendly. They weren't British enough. Well, how can they be British enough? They're coming with trauma as refugees. And you want them to assimilate in a way that, you know, anyhow, the point is that that's one aspect, no? And people are talking about scarcity. Well, of course, there's scarcity because there is a limited jobs because they're all being funneled elsewhere because the rich are seeing that there's an opportunity for them to make more money if they pay their workers less. So there's less work here. And food scarcity, well, there's no such thing as really food scarcity except for profit, if it's driven by profit, right? Because tons of food is being wasted and thrown out if it's to interfere with their competitiveness, competition in the markets. When people talk about issues, I think that they are normally talking about the superficial reasons why, and they're not looking deeply. That if you trace back to it, it comes down to really that there is a system in place that drives immigration. There are wars that exist, you know. I remember being in England and I remember people talking about the refugees a lot and people did not like the immigration. This is prior to Brexit. I was there in a very crucial time in 2015 and people were very afraid. As in Florida last week, I remember talking to a lot of people there that they are afraid of the socialist ideology that Bernie Sanders talks about. And Florida tends to be, so I think that swing state because Latinos there, there's a very heavy Latino population, but there's a lot of Venezuelans, Nicaragüenses, and Cubanos from so-called socialist countries, and they don't want socialism, so they tend to be more conservative. And but when you talk to, like I was saying, the people in England and here, people are saying they don't want immigration, and they think that people are just coming here for jobs, when they're really coming from war-torn countries. And who are waging those wars? It's the very same countries that are denying immigration and refugees, and there's a context, right? And people don't look at historical contexts. And so my job in listening to people was to trace back where their fears would come from. And sometimes I would engage in political discussion, sort of telling them, well, let's look back a little bit. If you go back some years, let's go to the 80s, or let's go back to Reagan years, or even, let's not even go too far, 18 years ago, Bush era. We can just trace back to the Middle East wars. Or let's talk about, when you're talking about jobs, let's look at the disparity that exists between the rich and the poor in this country. Or, we just talk about other things. For example, racism. Well, I understand where this is coming from, but you're scapegoating here. This is not your enemy, really. There's someone else that's your enemy that has put these immigrants in front of you for you to target them instead of the people who you should be targeting behind that.
And these are the sorts of things you might put in front of people.
I would, if I would have these conversations if they wanted to, but for me personally, I think it was a sort of a moment for me to listen to people. I tried to have those discussions, but 80% of the time, I was just listening and listening and listening and listening and listening to people and listening to Jake. And in my head, I would listen to what he was saying, take in the information, and then slowly, for me, look at what he is talking about. Well, what is he talking about? Right? He's talking about the government is subsidizing the oil industry. And then I would say in my head, right, when he'd talk, because I'd let him talk, I wouldn't interrupt, then I would say, all right, well, yes, that, of course that happens because they're both benefiting, right, as I said earlier. And then that's how I would trace things in my head. Or he'd talk about other things, such as privilege. And so I would listen, and I'd say, well, yeah, there is an issue with privilege. And we have discussed it here on What's Left, which is identity politics. And I have already stated the position. I'm not going into it right now. Please, people, check out the episode right now. I'm not going to go into it right now. And then the other one we would talk about would be other things like I would talk about how it's very difficult to have honest conversations on the left without being shut down. And there is almost this militancy of shutting down anyone. And he would say it in terms like there is this mania, or however, the Ranger syndrome exists on the left or whatever. And I would say that people have done not like that, but I would say that people do become very sensitive, defensive, and groupthink. And as we have discussed here on What's Left, that people do shut down political conversations on the left, and that's the undoing of the left. And so I agree with him in that sense. Not the stuff that he would state, but just that you cannot have an honest conversation and risk being ousted, risk being ostracized, and then we just end up pushing everyone to the right, really. So that's how I would interpret a lot of the things he would say. Anyhow, the point is that this deep listening also made me think about how much the Republicans and Democrats are benefiting from all of this chaos, from this division, and how they work and collide, or excuse me, collude to make this division benefit for them both, right? They may not agree on everything, but they certainly agree on maintaining the system. and that system, however which way they want to go about it, they both strongly, the Democrats and the Republicans, strongly agree with making the system stronger for the rich, for the people, the elite class, and to uphold capitalism. And that's where they are scamming us both. I have knew this intellectually, but it really resonated deeply within me in Florida when I was there. I realized, my God, all of this, you know, opposition that we are having is working for the elite class, because everyone wants to pick a side. And yet, that's how I think that, yeah, that's benefiting for the Democrats and Republicans.
So I guess one of the things I hear in what you're saying is, when you used to have these discussions, you used to discuss sort of like the difference of opinion about an issue as it relates to immigration, or an issue as it relates to the environment, maybe. But now you still might disagree with the issues with the people you're talking about, but you're listening from the framework of, how do I understand what is at the root of their fear? You know, now they might not see it that way. They might not see it as capitalism coming down.
No, but, they don't. Right. They don't see it that way.
But since you're listening from the framework of saying, well, what is the, not just what are the root causes of the issues that you see in the system, but as you listen to them, you're like, oh no, it's the same root causes. And so that causes you to hear it differently.
Yeah, it really does. And the, I know they don't see it that way because they're, people tend to be inundated with propaganda, really, from the media about socialism, about anarchism, about anything that, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans both do it. Try to really scare you away from, they use Venezuela and starving children and China to really scare you.
And North Korea.
In North Korea, to scare you that that's not where we want to go, so better focus here. And people are so focused on that. So yeah, I agree that. And so you cannot have a discussion about those things or even help them trace back. You sort of, I realize I have to talk about other things where we find common ground to bring their energy in a way that sort of don't see me as a threat. I realize just in general, if we are to have a political movement, we are to try to really reach out, I believe, to the other side, so to speak. I'm putting air quotes here because, I, again, we'll talk about political linear ideology, if it's really left or right. I don't think of it as linear anymore. But I think I'll use it for conventional reasons, that I think that if we're trying to, we have to really work together. We have to really put some differences to the side, some of them, but I think that we have to try to sort of reach that base. Now, you won't reach everyone, but you have to try to talk and not have this you versus I, them versus us way of doing things.
Well, this is one of the things that at least resonated with me about this was the idea that the what we called about Trump derangement syndrome, and the notion that so many people were getting upset about Trump, much of that upsetness is a sense that his base, his, the people who support Trump or that, that represent that support in this country, that all of them are people that are not worth talking to, that the left has no basis for talking to them. The left has nothing to they have nothing to offer the left, and the left has nothing to offer them. Because they're over there. They're the racists. They're the nationalists. They're the Nazis, essentially, and the fascists. And I think that has been a false, that that has been a false, there are fascists, there are, you know, white supremacists, but I don't think that's the, by any stretch, the majority of the people who support Trump or support Sanders or support Clinton or support, or don't vote at all. I think the vast majority of people in this country think things are messed up. But have drawn very different conclusions about what's behind that. But I do agree, if you listen as a revolutionary, or if you listen from the framework of understanding that capitalism is the problem, you can hear in many people that that sense that what they're really upset about is the same thing that I'm upset about, is the same thing that I'm trying to fight, although they don't see it that way.
Right.
They think it's about going after the immigrant. They think it's going... Mm-hmm. And but they're... So I do agree that there's that possibility of the common ground if we come to the same understanding of that core problem. Because if they continue to think that the immigrant is the problem, if they continue to think that it's the black person or the woman or something like that, we will have a problem. There's no...
Yes, it's true. Yeah. But I think what happens with people, again, for conventional reasons, I don't want to go into what other way I want illustration that best illustrates for us what ideology looks like. Mm-hmm. I'll just use this very conventional left and right linear way, right? I think that for most people on the right, because we're speaking from the left, right? I think for most people on the right, what happens is sexism, right? For example, women's rights, and they're just, this is very loud for them. They're not able to hear you, and we're not able to hear them. And this becomes an issue where we're not listening because there's so much noise in the background about, about women taking away men's manhood, or people thinking that, you know, they're brainwashed almost. I feel that people are thinking that there is this people, they're after my my guns, and they're coming for me, and so this is so focused on this specific issue. When if you to talk to people for some time, after a while, if you sort of just talk about something sort of around, I don't know how to describe this, but the way that I try to talk about people, to talk to people, isn't so much to try to, this might not even sit well with a lot of progressives, but isn't so much to say that they are wrong. I don't make people feel wrong. I tend to sort of listen to what they're trying to say and see that it's rooted in their fear that they're losing a job. This one came up a lot, for example. Immigration came up a lot for me in Florida. That's why I'm picking this one. They're afraid of their job being lost to other people. And why would they be afraid of their job? Because they depend on this specific job that they've only been able to qualify for because of their background and education, because of the educational system that failed them, that were not able to, for them, to meet the qualifications for them to get a so-called better job. There's, if you just go back and you trace back, a lot of these people that I spoke to in Florida have had some way of explaining to me a lot of explanations that I thought, okay, I can already see the failure in the educational system, the failure in, you know, just that the companies that have not sustained jobs in their locality. And the rhetoric that comes from everyone that says that the immigrants are coming for their jobs, and as well as the just the rhetoric around Muslims and people, the stereotypes and the racism that comes about other people that are not true. I remember talking about to someone, and they said something about how Mexicans are all gangs and everyone, and they're just all of them are, you know. And I thought, did you know I'm Mexican? Oh, you're very nice.
And that's this time?
This is this time. And, you know, it's like, so I try not to be offended by it, right? But I said, well, I'm not the exception. There are lots of people that are not in gangs like me. So just having to be a little, just listening to people, and I think that people don't have, I don't know how to explain this, Andy. I think people are just operating through fear. And then we operate. The problem with we is that we tend to sort of, what do you do? Like you those in deplorables, you know.
Right.
Where people, I mean, maybe they don't, you know, don't experience life in their small towns, or, you know, they just go home after a long surviving day of trying to put food on their table and watching the news, which tends to be Fox News, and people tend to just sort of live their life. You know, they're not going to delve into a lot of things. Maybe they don't have money to even have a passport to travel and to see what the other people and other cultures are like. And you know, the rhetoric that comes from Fox News, I'm not saying it's all propaganda, CBS, ABC, all of it, right? I'm just saying that this specific network is known for, come on, you know, Sean Hannity has clearly said things, and just recently as well as Laura Ingrid, and as well as Tucker Carlson, very specific things about people that look like me, very specific things. And their voices tend to be louder than some of the people at CBS. I mean, I can't think of even an anchor right now that has said things about Mexicans. So I'm sure they have. I'm sure there are racists within those networks. I'm just saying that these people have just made themselves notoriously, right, for speaking about people that tend to look like me. And so anyhow, this is their vision, this is their understanding of who people look like me. And but when they talk to me, they're like, oh, well, things change for them, right? And I realize that most people here in San Francisco, they would immediately shut down a person like that. They would immediately try to make them feel stupid and say that they are a Nazi. And when I talk to them, I don't really feel threatened, like they're going to after me and put me in a concentration camp. I'm just saying, maybe that's not, I don't know, PC correct, but once talking to them was like, well, it's just my fear. Like, then they talk about other things besides me being in a gang. They'll say things. It was just my fear of just making sure that, you know, my child goes to a nice school and they want their family to live adequately and comfortably, maybe not rich. And they are afraid of the terrorism that exists. And they don't realize that the USA is actually the number one terrorist nation in the entire planet, right? Terrorizing other countries. You know, and then their numbers are quite off when they talk about domestic terrorism. They don't realize that actually the higher percentage of actually white young men have terrorized this country. So those things are a little off, but because, you know, I guess they're not, I don't see it as deplorables. I think people just like on the left as well, when they watch other things as listening to CNN, I think that's the equivalent of Fox News. They'll just do the same thing about the people in the middle of the USA, which they'll have their own rhetoric. But I'm not speaking about that because I was visiting Florida. So people have their ideas. Even Latinos, you know, from Venezuela were saying, oh, I don't want to go back to those times. And I've discovered a lot of Venezuelans and Cubans actually are very middle class in Florida. So I have a different perspective from how Latinos here in California are, which tend to be more of the working class. So difference in class I've noticed as well, which will give different perspective as far as how you see things, right? The middle class do want to maintain a certain level of power, and the working class don't even think about power. They're thinking about surviving.
Well, how do you see, because I think one of the issues people will
I think
make,
this will be a very controversial
well, we'll see. I mean,
video.
one of the things people will say is, well, you know, NBC and CBS, well, they're bad, they're mainstream media, but at least they don't say as badly, you know, the racist stuff like Tucker Carlson and stuff like that.
Right.
This is the claim that people will make for, you know, the difference, say, between Trump and the Trump Republican Party and the Democratic Party.
Right. And I think for me, there's for me, it's I tend to be what you see is what you get sort of person. And I think I feel this probably will sound wrong, people will twist my words here, but I think I feel more comfortable knowing that Sean Hannity actually says what he says and Tucker Carlson than people who are censoring themselves in front of a camera, but are maybe sending messages or sending all kinds of racist messages amongst their friends. That is more scary to me because and you don't really know what people are thinking. And you know, you have this sort of, you want to portray yourself a certain way in front of the camera, right? And so you don't want to lose your job or whatever. And this sort of censorship, I think that people try to impose on themselves and also networks impose on their anchors, is sort of hiding places for people who just to say what they really think. I don't like the things that come from Sean Hannity. I don't like the things that come from Tucker Carlson, but they're honest and I know who they are and I know where I differ and I know where I'm not going to engage or indulge with him. But you don't know where people are coming from, left or right, here on this on other mainstream media. And I think if I have to say one positive thing about Fox News is their honesty, at least on that side. I mean, that side, that aspect. I'm not saying they're honest with their finances or honest with the. No, there's a lot of corruption at all levels, as well as we have seen in the past few years, where Fox News at the higher level, even there's corruption about hiding things. But I'm not talking about that right now. I'm talking about the opinions that come out of these anchors. They're honest, and I don't appreciate it, but they're saying it how it is. I'd rather hear it than have people who are saying all kinds of things behind back room doors.
And was there anything that you heard from people when you were in Florida? Was there anything that changed your perspective about how you saw things? Or was it actually something that more confirmed your perspective around things?
Oh, this one is going to be tough. I think it's around guns. I think that Jake convinced me to see guns like a tool. I'm not going to buy one, and I'm not interested. I don't think I'll ever. I have shot in the past with a shotgun, and I was in Idaho. A long time ago, when I was an adolescent, I think it was sort of a rite of passage, and a friend of mine was trying to have me just try it as someone from a liberal city. But I think the gun issue, I realize, is something I have shifted my position on several times, even some of the things that you have even said, because it's I used to just say no to guns. And now I will not carry one myself, but I think that the way that he talked about guns as a way to, as a tool, and not to kill people, but as a way to defend yourself, even from the government, that something similar to what you had said as well, and how the people need to arm themselves. I, because of my practice and because of my morals, personal morals, not like a theocratic religious morals, but spiritual morals. I'm still challenged by it, but there is some understanding of it in a way that I see how even a car is dangerous, right? And I'm not going to stop driving, right? Driving actually causes a lot of deaths, and it is a weapon, and it can actually kill Heather Heyer, right? So I think that there are other ways to kill people as well. And I think that even if we were to, I realize in the conversations around this issue, even if we were to ban all of guns, I think people, if want to kill, they'll find ways to kill. That will be either with knives, that will either be making homemade weapons. There will always be some way, I think, that people will kill. And I think that I've realize it's not so much the gun issue, it's something deeper than guns. It's there's something, there's the psyche of our collective population that is happening. There's a crisis that is not just, it is mental health, yes, but it's also the rhetoric that's coming from the elite class to divide us as working folks and to scapegoat other people that we need to tackle. That is not going to be done with taking away people's guns. This is my understanding. And this is how I've seen this now issue. Whereas I would go to the gun, and the gun, as I have just said it earlier, can be banned, but people will always find ways to hurt each other. And so the issue around guns, I think, was for me a turning point in our conversations. But it has taken also conversations with you, it's taken conversations with him. And both of you really have influenced me on how I shift around that. I realized too that background checks, there are so many background checks that you can have, and still you'll have some loophole anywhere, or some I don't want to use the word loophole because it's actually very it's used for political reasons. I will say that you will never be able to have perfect background check to sift through the people who will find ways to shoot others for political reasons, for mental health reasons, whatever it may be.
Conversely, do you feel like, or are you aware of any way in which you influenced the people you talked to, whether it be Jake or the other folks there?
One thing I did, I think I found some way to influence Jake is, he's not going to like this, but one thing we were talking a lot about economics, and he has a lot of questions about Marxist economics that I was sadly not able to answer, which I think we'll do some episode in the future with, where he can actually ask you, and you have to really answer those questions because they were tough
questions. Hopefully I can. We'll see.
I mean, he was delving into supply and demand, and he was talking about the market, and he was going into other realms. And I don't think I have gone too far with other people because I can sort of answer some of the questions as current events, but he's talking about a system that will work and function in his ideal capitalism and challenging in an ideal socialism system, which I struggled with. But one thing I think that he was able to sort of, I think, shift on was we were talking about how to distribute resources, and I know that one of the issues he has with socialism is that he wonders a lot about how, I forget how many people died, millions of people died in China for the socialism or the famine that existed.
Right, during the Cultural Revolution, things like that.
As well as in Soviet Union. And he was talking about how would you be able to sustain agriculture and be able, we were drawing even like our own, let's say our own ideal nation. We'd spent the entire day, just me drawing up sort of a fictitious land. I feel like I was being J.K. Tolkien here, J.R. Tolkien, drawing up my ideal of socialism, futurism. But one thing that I think did move for him was that if the basics were covered, healthcare, food, education,
shelter,
if the basics were covered, we humans would have more time and possibly less time trying to figure out how to keep these things or food on the table, that we would be able to become ingenious in other areas and to expand evolutionarily as human development. If these things were covered, if the basics were covered, we would be able, I convinced him of this. I said that this would just make us even AIG, what is this? Or the robots thing? What's the
artificial intelligence?
Yeah, artificial AI. I said AIG. Excuse me. Yeah. AI. Even AI would not be a threat for folks because we have discussed this as well. Because it would actually not be taking away people's jobs. It would be doing tedious work that we don't
freeing
have to take
people care. Up to kind of do the things that they'd like to do.
And I think that our creative juices would be fired up in some way to create who knows what. And imagine what we have done under capitalism. Now imagine what we could do under socialism if those basics were covered. I think people would discover all kinds of things. And I think in that area, Jake was convinced that that is an interesting thought. He would just like to see how it would play out, and how would you do that? How would you cover the basics?
Right. Yeah. Well, it's been interesting for me to listen to this because I think one of the common things you've talked about is your understanding as you listen, that you're understanding that at the root of this is fear, right?
Oh yeah, and a lot of it. Yeah.
And I agree with that. And I think the fear that people don't quite identify because they don't identify as members of the working class. As you've asked me this question before, well, what makes a worker a worker? And what makes a worker is the only way they can make a living is having a job. That the wage of that job is how they make a living. Literally, whether they have a house, whether they have food, whether they have that security is all based on do you have a job?
Yeah.
And that it is that fear game that puts that the capitalist uses against every worker. And that is the situation under conditions where we just had a crisis in 2008. People know that there may be a crisis coming.
Recession.
This so-called boom has not been a boom for other people. It has gone from full-time jobs to part-time jobs, like we see with the auto workers. The auto workers have had a recovery, but it's been at the expense of their fellow workers. They have more temporary workers. Other workers have all faced this sort of situation. So that insecurity has grown. And that insecurity about, can I hold on, is like, how many fingers can I keep on the cliff shelf, you know? Mm-hmm. And it unfortunately has been redirected towards mm-hmm. women, towards immigrants, towards black people, towards people in other nations, towards Muslims. It's been even, and even some of that fear has been to get people to deflect away from their own fear of their situation onto a fear of some terrorist at ISIS, somebody like thousands of miles away who will literally not be doing anything to your job, mm-hmm. you know, to get people to think that there's something else that they need to be afraid of. So I do think it's that fear that the capitalist is tapping into. And the Democratic and Republican Party, I do believe, are both benefiting from obscuring who the real opponent is, real enemy is, and trying to appeal to that fear in different ways, mm-hmm. in different false ways. And both of them provide a false solution, a non-solution to the source of people's fear. And that is something that the left, I think, has missed. It has missed the fact that the base that we often talk about, the base of Bernie Sanders, many socialists talk about that our political base is the people who support Bernie. First of all, some of the people who supported Bernie in 2016 voted for Trump in 2016 as well. Mm-hmm. They did, you know. But the reality is yes, there's a base among Bernie supporters, but there's also a base among Trump supporters for socialist ideas. Mm-hmm. If we can hear it, if we can hear that there's a common area coming from that. And because what's animating that support is anxiety, is fear, and is disgust with the establishment, mm-hmm. And a real cynicism about the mainstream media, which we as revolutionary socialists, let's say, I'm just saying me, you know, mm-hmm.
right.
share,
right.
you know. So I think that there has been something missed here about the breadth, how broad our potential base is, and I think we've actually gone down the road of going towards the Democratic Party, of adopting an identity politics frame that actually ultimately divides us, mm-hmm. thinking that there's something progressive in that, and there isn't. It's the end of what can be progressive, because what the thing that's progressive is the idea that we are members of the working class, mm-hmm. we are an exploited class, we are an oppressed class, we are not equally oppressed, but we are all oppressed and exploited, and our only solution to that is to come together and fight a common enemy. I don't know if you want to respond to any of that, because that's a kind of...
No, you're summarizing what I think, or, you know, except when you say revolutionary, I think... I don't know if I consider myself to be revolutionary, because I do feel I need to really start engraving where my political position is before I consider myself to be a revolutionary.
Okay, but I think you listened with the same framework I feel like I would try to listen to.
Yes, I think that that's where when you touch on that, I definitely do. I think when I think of myself, and I've said this to you before, how do we ally folks? Don't scare them. And I don't think, I think sometimes you do scare people.
Yes. Yes, yes.
But when you tell someone, I don't believe in privilege, it's like telling someone, a Trump supporter, the same thing. With different thing, you might say.
Look, I think we would disagree with about how to engage people, but we might not disagree with how to listen. There's a difference between how to respond and how to listen.
Yes, this is true. Yes,
and
different from responding and to listen.
Right, and I think in some ways, because I bring up Brandy here, because Brandy was sort of like, well, what's the big deal? Because I thought you should listen to what Eduardo said at the end of this thing, and she was like, what's the big deal? He realized was that Republicans and Democrats are both lying. But here's, and I'm probably, Brandy's going to be upset with me on this one.
You should delete that.
We'll see if it happens. But the fact is Brandy, we've talked about how I can go into a Republican town and talk to people and listen to people, and it doesn't rattle my cage. Mm-hmm. You know, actually, I get triggered more with liberals. That's the reality.
Yeah.
But I actually do believe that what you've described is is the key towards people who are on the left going to people who are on the right and being able to be among them and actually engage them honestly and in a real way, to say you actually have to hear where that person's coming from. You might not draw the right same conclusion about that person. Might think their source of their fear is an immigrant. You think the source of their fear ultimately resides in capitalism and insecurity of it. You're able to hear it.
Yeah.
But you're able to hear it and empathize with it and say, I think I could organize you if I can get you. But here is one thing. I want to come back to the...
I think I know what you're going to say next.
Well, maybe. Remember, there was an actual episode of a bunch of workers, white workers, coming over to some black workers, Latino workers, and saying, you can't be in my country, you can't talk, da, da, da. There is something that does have to be addressed there.
Right.
And it's not good enough. It is not good enough for us to be in solidarity, for me to be like, well, that could have been anyone.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
There is going to be a necessity of solidarity that says that those sorts of ideas are not, we're gonna push against those ideas. We're not going to allow us to be divided with those ideas.
Right, right.
And that does mean defense at that point.
Yeah. So I think that you touched two things I want to say. One is that when you talk to people, when one talks to people, normally you're on the defensive mode or the offense, no? And you're trying, and if you operate what you just said under this lens of trying to seek how we can make each other, how we can see each other eye to eye, that there's something systemic going on here beyond this superficial stuff that people are trying to use to divide us, then if you get to it and you're still disagreeing, at least you've sifted through enough to find where you really disagree.
Correct. That's correct.
That is where I'm trying to get at when I'm trying to find out. And I think that once you get to that, you will see, all right, we're not on the same team. But first get there, right. I think that. You have to get there.
Yeah.
And I have found the majority of people that I have spoken to, actually, we have a lot in common.
Yes.
Specific people like my friend Jake, on this issue of capitalism, I think we have still struggled because of this area of economics where we disagree that capitalism is the culprit here, because he still is left with a lot of questions. And unfortunately, I have told him, and if he listens to this, I cannot speak on behalf of the socialists, so I apologize. And I feel as if maybe I did him a disservice.
No.
So the point is that I think that if once those issues get, even that side of that aspect of socialism gets settled and gets sifted through, and he still disagrees, well, then you know what camp you are.
Yeah,
right. But you have to, my idea is that you first have to sift through to get to, all right, what are we left with that we can really get into the meat of the issue to discuss and really see where we disagree? Because that's what Jake and I did with other issues. And when we did that, we found really the place where we disagreed. And we found the place where we didn't disagree as well. So on many different diverse issues. And we were able to block out the noise that was distracting us and the ego as well, because the ego can get in there and then you become, you know, you up one each other trying to say, well, I'm smarter than you are, or even using some insults like, oh, that's stupid, that's bullshit, or something. I should probably edit that. Mm-hmm. But you know what I mean? Like, you start saying these words. Well, let's not use these languages right now, or let's not use that sort of writing. Let's not undermine each other. Let's just get through, you know, a good argument, the intelligible, intelligent, articulate argument here. Mm-hmm. And let's sift through it. So yes, I do think what, just touch base, is that there are going to be differences, but you first have to sift through them to find what those differences are. And then you'll really say, yeah, we're on different camps. We're just really on different camps.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I don't think that most people enter a conversation like that. Mm-hmm. I think people immediately see, we're on different camps.
Right.
I'm not going to listen to you.
And you never even get to the root to see where those real divisions might lie and where those areas of actual commonality may exist.
Right. Yeah. Right. So that's one. Now the topic about what happened.
I'm not bringing this up as a means of like calling out.
No,
I'm saying
no.
That there is something about solidarity that does have to take place that is not up for debate.
Yes, yes.
It's debatable. I mean, but if you do debate it, we won't unite as a class and we won't win. We will not defeat the capitalists.
Right.
It will have to be we will have to become convinced as members of this class that we have a stake in defending each other against a common enemy.
Yes. And it almost feels that sometimes when you're talking to other people, and this has happened with me, for example, with deaf folks, right? When people tell me that they're going through something and I sort of have a blind spot for it because I see that I didn't have the experience of not hearing in my life ever. And I try to sort of give that example as, well, I've had other examples as being Mexican. And here I can tell you this is the same thing. But it's not the same thing for a deaf person.
Yeah.
There is a difference with going through life, going through with the loss of hearing, that you have other ways to compensate for. That I realized for myself I was not listening to it. Different experiences, and I don't think it comes to even being white, because even when I talk to my family, my cousins who are the same age as me, they're just other experiences that they have experienced that I have not experienced. And I think everyone just has a different life and experience, and so when I, one thing I notice is that when people are a little bit, you connect with them on just suffering. If you connect with them, this is something I learned from my practice, from meditation. If you connect with people with suffering, just suffering in general, and this hurts for me, and this is how I felt, and I need you to listen because this hurts me. This, I need it to be safe. And you don't bring it, and you don't try to make it political. But there are people, and yes, I have to say, there are people, once you sift through, and once you also realize, like, race is also an issue here, you know, and racism exists, you know, and people still try to deny it, then yeah, of course, once you get to it, and even then, when you try to reason with people, and you really, and they just, like, nope, race is not an issue, and, you know, and not from the identity politics aspect, perspective. I'm talking about like race, like structural racism exists because the capitalist class uses it to divide us, and people still are stubborn and they're not wanting to listen to it, then you've already seen where the disagreement is. Mm-hmm. And that is, as I had said earlier, is where you can find, all right, you're not going to be an ally for this revolutionary cause.
All right, or at least not at this moment. And it might be in the context of a future struggle that
right.
people see
yes.
how those divides get played out. And maybe they understand, oh, I was wrong. Because there is a wrong and right here.
And I do believe that people can change, by the way. Mm-hmm. I truly do believe. I don't think that some people on the left, once you're racist, always a racist.
Right.
Once you're a sexist, always a sexist. Once mm-hmm. you're this way, always this. I don't think that that's how I function. I don't think people...
Well, if it is true, then revolution is not possible.
Yeah.
If it's true that people are
You have
fixed.
To be willing to allow for forgiveness, apology. Yeah. And there has to be lots of, you know... on both sides, I think. Mm-hmm. I hate using the word both sides because Trump has coined it, right?
I do think that when I say the other side, on the right, on the people who are Republicans, I don't think it's about me adopting their ideas about
I'm not talking about
yeah,
that.
Right.
Yeah, but I'm glad you're saying it, so
yes.
be clear. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is about listening. And like I said, I agree with the... I'm not for gun control. Like, I agree with that idea of workers arming themselves to defend themselves, things like that. But that's to make working class... My notion of workers being able to have guns is even... I want the immigrant worker who's crossing the border, they should be able to be armed, right? Because they're a fellow worker with me.
Yeah.
You know, so that is where we will... That's where the right doesn't agree, right? Because they don't... They're anti-immigrant and things like that, nationalist.
Right.
So, and I'm not interested in preserving national borders and boundaries.
Right.
I'm interested in only the international working class, and ultimately, workers' councils internationally organizing how production goes on, and everyone gets housing, everyone gets fed, all that. You know. So,
thank you for clarifying, anti-ESC.
Yeah,
that's what I mean.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I'm going to adopt either.
Right, right.
Some of the ideology
so
that exists on that other side.
Right. But the framework from which many of the people who are on the right are coming. Is not as far away from us as we think. That's what I would say. It's not as far away from, it's not just Bernie bros that are our audience. You know, women supporters or male supporters of Bernie, I shouldn't say Bernie bros, but there are people across the, what we would say the complete other spectrum whose anger and fear is rooted in an experience of capitalism, even if they don't see it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's one of the things that I feel like I was, I don't know, I just wanted to hear more from you about that experience that you had in Florida.
Well, here's what I think I will wrap up with. I think that what I see in Israel and I see in Palestina is Palestine is what I think is perfect for the Zionists, for Benjamin Netanyahu, right? It is perfect. This division creates the perfect way to make people do exactly what you want them to do. And it works, right? From both sides, really. So if they were re what would happen if you had the Jews and the Arabs or Palestinians talk to each other, really talk to each other to find a way, let's work through this. They are using us, they are our puppets. Really, you would overthrow the entire government for both. I want to be revolutionary. I think we have to set up an army camp. I don't want to say
Finally.
that on public. We have to find allies. And allies will be crossing the bridge, creating bridges, and making and hearing other people out. And I think that that's why you and I really, with the impetus for this What's Left program, was for us to have these challenging conversations. And if you've gotten to this far, I think that that's the message I want to leave with, is that I truly listened. And even listening to some other people, like I would think that San Francisco sort of classic progressive folks here would consider a racist. They weren't actually being very racist to me, even though they said a lot of racist things, but I realized they weren't racist as a person once you sort of, okay, all right, let's get deeper, right? And then we talked, and they saw me as very much like them. And they said, "Oh, you're the exception." Oh, I think they'd make a lot of exceptions once they got to know everyone. And so it's really, conversations will have to be had. And I think that that's what we're really trying to do here.
And I never really thought about it this way, but just to distinguish between listening and agreeing, those are different things. You can listen and not agree. You can listen, but can you listen and understand? That's where some of those questions are coming from, and that's where you can ask questions to try to essentially do reconnaissance on a potential ally, on a potential person who I'm wanting to bring closer to me. I want to know where they're coming from, and so I do think that is something the left has fallen down deeply. And it did it, when you go to our first episode, why we're doing this. We did talk about how the left is not able to talk with itself, let alone people outside of itself, and that is a very that hamstrings us for the possibility of becoming better organizers and finding other people who are going to be part of our cause, a cause for change. So I do think that this episode kind of brings us a bit full circle to that initial episode, and you basically just had an experience of really being able to listen differently than you had in the past.
Well, I think I would say that I have always listened, but like I listen like a Jeffrey Epstein.
I should let you speak for yourself instead of,
But I think it became for this last trip that I made, it was listening. I think I listened at a more deeper level, deeper. I went into it deeper. So it because I think prior to that trip, I was secretly rooting for some folks in the Democratic Party. Now I'm trying to really trying to
Move out of that paradigm.
get out of that relationship.
The abusive.
It's not abusive, it's codependent, but loving. Not really,
Yeah. I would say that they're smacking people around, but telling them they love them. I love you, baby. Boom. Anyway, well, thank you, Eduardo. And thanks for taking, I know this wasn't the last thing you ever wanted to do.
Yeah.
but
we'll
I
focus
appreciate
on you next time.
Well, I think we've got a few interviews coming. I think Will's coming up, the dude from North Carolina. We'll have to see. I don't really know what's on the horizon for us in the next few weeks.
So. Well, I would have liked to have covered the UN summit. The summit.
Climate?
Yes, the climate. But not just that. It was the United Nations. We missed it. You know, happened all last week.
Sure, there's nothing.
And we weren't there.
Carving up the globe for the rich, basically. Anyway, we can figure out what we'll do next week. Next week.
All right.
All right. So for now?
We'll end it with this. All right. So if you please rate, review, subscribe to any of our five platforms that we have. It's Google Play, iTunes Podcast, YouTube, BitChute or Stitcher. Rate, review, and subscribe. And best of all, share with your family and friends. And we will catch you all next week.
All right. Take care.